that the Sewer and Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 315 at 3 o'clock p.m. on May 21st, 1975.
But I very well, I have a face for that we delete line 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14.
You're going to have to move to reconsider the motion by which Senate Bill 312 was passed out of committee.
That's an effort.
No, no, I'm sorry.
That's an effort.
I'm sorry. You're right.
Because it's holding this place on the charter, it'll be actually, looking at your bill, it'll be section 15 and 16. And that's the advertising section of the accountancy bill. The amendment reads on page 12 of the bill to leave line 10 through 14. And that takes care of the whole thing.
Okay, and the explanation is that...
I move the adoption of the amendment.
That the accountants include this in their code of ethics, and the Newspaper Publishing Association is uptight about it being in the law.
Yeah, and the board of accountancy and newspaper people, I had an agreement that we're doing the house, but the president said it wasn't done here, so that's the effect.
The motion is to delete the portions of the bill referred to by Senator Howard. Is there discussion? Is there an objection? Motion carries.
I move to set it back to the floor. Due pass is about it.
Motion is that we repass Senate Bill 312 and send to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Correct.
Is there discussion?
Hello. Senator Burbidge?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm on the vote, I didn't know what that was voting on.
You can do it also.
I heard him say aye.
When I get the vote? Oh, pardon me. Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge, abstain. Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Dristy?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. House Bill 2386. Jerry, you got amendments from Chris Cassidy. Tom Bessonette in the room? Tom, is it true? Chris says that these amendments you have no objections to, is that right?
That's correct. I have no objections to the amendments by Chris.
Okay. Is this the one that's been put into the...
2386. I believe it is.
Just if we could say it.
Discrimination of handicap. Right, sure.
This proposal, Tom, is signed by Mr. Worley. Have you seen it?
I think I have, Madam Chair. This is the one from the... Yes, the definition in sub B.
Right.
Physically handicapped. Yes, we have no objections to those amendments.
Okay. Do I hear a motion?
Move the adoption of the amendments.
Motion is to adopt the amendment before you. Is there discussion?
Question.
Is there an objection to the amendment? The amendment is adopted.
Move the bill out.
Senator Burbidge moves House Bill 2386 to the floor, and I think it should be engrossed, Senator Burbidge, because we've made some changes, as you can see, quite extensively. With a due pass recommendation, is there discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook? Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
You get
2082.
Aye.
Is ready.
Senator Smith? Aye. Madam Chairman? Aye. House Bill 2082. We have some amendments on that one. For the benefit of the committee, the information of the committee, the President says that a few of us can be excused to continue taking testimony on the bills that we have signed, so you can all begin to decide which ones of you want to go back to the floor and which ones of you want to stay here. I'd like to keep five until we get out a few more bills, particularly the insurance commissioner's bills. House Bill 2082, this is the amendment that is intended to exempt pre-fried products. Is there a motion?
Move the adoption of the amendment.
Motion is to adopt the amendment for you. Is there discussion?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Madam Chairman, I think that an attempt such as this to restrict application of this bill is commendable, but I don't believe this amendment does it. And I suggest that we're meddling here with a situation which could be have more impact than we recognize. And if this amendment is adopted, I'd certainly hope that you would conduct and open up this question again to another hearing to make sure that this committee understands what it's doing if the amendment is adopted, thinking that it's going to relieve the situation.
In other words, you'd like to have the people who objected to this provision to appear again
to
the amendment. Further discussion?
I wonder how long we're going to have. This is Wednesday. We're going to meet Friday. Is this committee going to meet Friday? Going to meet any other time?
Depends on how far we go.
We got a slug of bills here, plus a little old thing called medical malpractice. I suspect it's going to take some of our time. I don't know how many more hearings we're going to get to.
Well, we may be having more meetings than this committee has been having in the past in order to get through the necessary bills, but we'll face that when we get to it. Is there further discussion? Clerk, call a roll on the amendment.
What was the source of this amendment?
The source of the amendment is the from the sponsor of the bill. Really not the sponsor of the bill, but the person who's been appearing in favor of the bill, primarily Jerry Grimm, and I think she is the one who actually drafted the amendment, sent it in. And it was changed then by Jerry, who worked it into a little bit better form. Clerk will call a roll on the amendment.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Drewston?
No.
Senator Chairman?
Aye.
Four ayes.
Motion's carried to amend. Okay, the bill is amended. Jerry, will you contact us? Do I hear any further motion?
I'll move it out.
Motion is to move House Bill 2082 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Drewston?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails. Jerry, will you contact the people who were concerned about this and check with them on the amendment?
No,
House Bill 2721. Your committee will recall was assigned to a subcommittee made up of Senator Cook, Senator Smith, yourself. Who else was there? Three of us, I guess. Met with Jane Earhart and with Mr. Healy and went through the bill section by section and sentence by sentence, practically. The subcommittee found no substantive or even technical problems with the bill. We do have one proposed amendment to consider. I would be most happy to call on Jane Gerhart and have her go through this and Mr. Healy section by section if the committee chooses to spend that time.
Madam Chairman, we haven't got, if our subcommittee went over it and breathed up until 3:30, I think, and today, and I'm perfectly willing to go with the
Jane,
after this one.
Okay. Appreciate that, Senator Hart. Since Senator Cook isn't here, did he have any concerns when you went through it with him personally?
I didn't feel that he had any particular concerns. All the questions he had, we were able to answer. If it was satisfaction, I'd have to call the commissioner with there too.
Okay. Senator Smith, what's your reaction to the...
Well, Madam Chairman, I looked at a lot of revision bills, and this is not as substantial as some, but it is substantial, and I just want to say that this bill is in excellent condition, and the commissioner and Jane Gerhart and others who helped draft it, I think, ought to be complimented. I am satisfied with it. As a member of the subcommittee, we went into it in some great depth. I would move the adoption of the amendment.
Okay, you have before you an amendment that has been proposed by Mr. Dobson from the Public Welfare Division, which has been approved by Mr. Healy, and Jane has seen the amendment, and there is no objections to the proposed amendment. Is there discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chairman, there was no opposition?
No. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment to House Bill 2721? Okay, do I hear a motion on the bill?
I'll move it to the floor, but it would violate my principles.
Did you?
Well,
we have discovered that Mrs. Gerhart has discovered a very minor conflict. Section 150 of this bill, which is a cleanup section, and 163, which is on out of Senate Judiciary Committee, is on the floor of the Senate tomorrow. And the conflicts are very minor, and I think it'd be fit together, and I would hope that if the committee in its wisdom passed the bill out today, that we would have the committee permission to work with the chair and tie those two minor conflicts together. So that this
are we going to conform it to the other bill that's already on the floor?
Conform it to the other bill. There's only one section in 2363 that conflicts with this bill, but there is just two little minor places where it does conflict, and obviously they should be in conformity because one would be negated someplace along the line.
They're just technical problems.
I have no objection.
Committee have any objection to conforming this bill to, what's the bill number?
2363.
2363, which will be on the floor tomorrow. Take an awful lot for granted in these late hours. Okay.
I would also suggest that we work with the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee to make sure it conforms with her desires too.
Okay. If there's any problem, the bill will not be reported out. Senator Smith moves House Bill 2721 to. To the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brenner?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Durstead?
Aye.
Senator Herman?
Aye.
Wasn't so hard, was it?
Okay, Mr. Rawls, how fast can you go through 2996 to 2997? Oh, and we left off on 29, where is he? We left off on 2995, didn't we?
I think it's pretty good.
Very
frequently.
All right. Was it 2995 that we were discussing?
Yes.
All right. House Bill 2995. You'll recall we were in the middle of it when we had to go to the floor of the Senate. And Senator Cook was causing us a little problem.
As usual.
think if you hurry before Senator Cook gets
well,
to
that bill merely increases the financial responsibility limits of liability from 10-20 up to 15-30, and we were discussing the costs implicit in that particular bill. I think that Tom Bessonette testified that the be about a 10% increase in premium, and that the average driver in the city of Portland, which is the highest rated district in the state of Oregon, is about $40 per 6 months, or about $80 a year. So you have an increase of about $8 a year to give that 15-30 increase. And as Mary pointed out, that is keep us up with the some of the advancing states. We're not the lowest, we're not the highest, we're in about the middle.
Okay,
there was one amendment.
Sure. Did we accept his amendment to change to 35?
Well, that one thing we should, that has to be because of the $5,000 property damage. That was a
Howard moves that we change on page 4, all of them.
Page 2.
2995.
No,
page 4, isn't it?
Page 4, on line 14, Madam Chairman, line 17, and line 19.
Now, that's the only place on page 4 now. Not 3.
No,
it's
this one here.
No. No, not page 3 doesn't apply.
No, page 4. Page 4. On page 4.
Oh, is that... If we don't change it every place, it is...
Well, your bill, it should have come from the House on page 3, line 8, with 15, line 10, 30.
That's what we have.
Right. And
you
find on page 4.
I see. Yeah.
Okay.
It's only on the uninsured. No,
we failed to include the $5,000 property damage that Senator Howard and added the two together, and we have to add $5,000 to make it 35 total.
All right. First. Senator Howard moves that on page 4, lines 14, 17, and 19, we change the figure from $30,000 in each place to $35,000. Discussion on that?
Does that cost any more money?
Well, no, this has to be done because of what we've done over here. We've changed the amount.
What you all did, I didn't.
We didn't do this.
That has no effect, Senator Burbidge, on the price.
It won't cost any more money.
Is there an objection to the adoption of the amendments? The amendments are adopted. Is there any further discussion on the bill or questions to Mr. Rawls? Is there any motion on the bill?
I have a conflict of interest, but I think it's necessary, and I do want everyone to know I'm in the insurance business, but it's to meet today's inflation, we have to go up, and I move that we send House Bill 2995 to the floor of the Senate do pass as amended.
Senator Howard moves House Bill 2995. Five to the floor. Clerk, discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Jernstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails. Let's go to
what you got?
We had 4.
I'll change my vote to aye, but reserve the right to oppose it to the floor.
Does that make time, Frank?
Yes.
Okay. Motion passes. Bill goes to the floor.
I may do the same thing, Madam Chair.
It got some work cut out for you, Mr. Rawls. 2996. In other words, you're both saying you don't want to carry the bill.
Yeah, right. Well, actually says I have to protect the insurance bank of it. The Senate House Bill 2996, Madam Chairman, corrects a problem that could develop up to this moment hasn't. But under page 10 in the bracket area states that no binder shall be valid beyond the 90 days. Quite frequently, fire insurance policies.
Page
10?
No, line 10.
Quite frequently, a person will have their coverage bound under a binder for some reason or another, either that the person get out to rate the premises or the commercial building or whatever it might be, and so they put it on what they call a binder. Now, the way this statute reads that if the binder shall not be valid beyond the 90 days, quite often binders do extend beyond the 90 days, and it certainly could be detrimental to the consumer that the company could take the position that the binder automatically terminates at the 90-day period and he wouldn't have any coverage. That wasn't the intent, I'm sure, of the legislature when they wrote this bill, nor is it the intent of the companies to do this, but I want to prevent that, so I'm going to put what our language does here is put the emphasis and the reaction on the company that if it doesn't write the policy within the 90 days, then the policy is deemed to be in force. And that's all it really does.
Questions?
Well, what it is then is the binder is an agreement that's bound by an exchange of money and in lieu of a contract that's supposed to be forthcoming. Is that right?
That's correct. Sometimes there's no exchange of the money, however. They say we're buying this because we don't know what the rate's going to be. You know, somebody comes up and the coverage is bound. And I don't really know why the 90-day period was put in there, except it's been 90 days. It's been a kind of a time limit that's been in the industry for years and years. But in the way this is written, it would say that after that 90 days, the binder dies and the person's out of coverage, which that requires the insured to try to keep up with these 90 days. And if he's a businessman, he relies upon his agent and the company, and so it just shifts the responsibility from the insured over to the company to act instead of the insured acting.
Other discussion? Committee have any desire to act on this bill? Okay, 2997.
Are you ready to vote on the floor?
I sure am.
All right, I'll send it and I'll move it. House Bill 2996. Set the floor of the Senate, do pass.
You've heard the motion, is there discussion?
If anybody has any questions, I can answer it for them.
You can carry the bill.
I'll carry it, oh yeah.
Okay. Clerk, call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. 2997.
Aye. This bill, Madam Chairman, is a bill for at present time. Every automobile policy for liability that you purchase, you get 10,000 or 20,000 limits of liability of uninsured coverage. In other words, if somebody injures you and they're liable and they're uninsured, do you have on your policy coverage for 10,000 per person, 20,000 per vehicle or per accident of coverage? This bill allows you that if you want to insure yourself for a higher limit against an uninsured motorist, if you want to carry 50,000, 100,000, or in my, for instance, my case, I carry 100,000, 300,000 limits of liability, that I can buy from my company. I have the option of buying in up to 100, 300 limits of liability. There will be a premium charge that I have to pay, of course, but at least I've got the right to insure myself for a higher limit if I should be injured by an uninsured motorist.
Are these your amendments, Mr. Ross?
Yes.
We're getting out
here? Yes. I'm sorry. I should have did. The way it came out, it only ended up 1,500, and also a person could, say, carry the basic limits of only 10, 20, and then buy 1,500, and that would not be an equitable relationship with the company. You should be allowed only to purchase that amount of uninsured motorist that you purchase to protect the person that you injure. And that's what these the amendments do.
Are there currently companies or insurers not offering insurance?
There are, I understand, a limited number, a few that made offers, but it isn't general across the board.
What would be their advantage to not offering other plans?
Not offering this? Oh, I don't know if there's any particular advantage. It's just kind of an idea that that hasn't blossomed out as yet. Some of them are just reluctant to expose themselves any more than what they have to.
Other discussion?
So I got that clear now. This is for uninsured. So the insured is the one who is the recipient of this against an uninsured motorist if he's got this extraordinary, or maybe it's the term extraordinary insurance that caused the damages to go that high, then they can be covered. Is that
right?
That's
right. He'd have that coverage. Quite often in uninsured motorists, those persons who pass through the state and drive without driver's license and stolen cars and so forth, cause an abnormal number of serious accidents because they're the type of person that they are. And often those people who are injured by those very serious accidents eat up their minimum 10-20 limits very quickly. And this allows at least, I personally don't know that there's any way you can make sure that every person on the highway has insurance, but at least you can protect yourself from that person by this.
Les, is there any way that we can put in here under the uninsured motorist, underline bodily injury, or put a parenthesis and put only in there so that the great bulk of people out there are not of the belief that their automobile will be repaired under the, you know, they say the fine print and everything, it seems to me, I don't think anybody reads it, but if it did, it's there. It would all, you know, it would say.
I don't know what you mean, because we run into that as you do all the time, because when a person's car is damaged, they're more concerned about the damage to their car than they are the damage to their body. But I don't know how you can overcome that. Seems like when they call our department,
I'll talk to the in-between sessions. Any way to make that plainer, what it covers, I would sure like to have it in.
I had hoped to be able to issue a bulletin or a little booklet on automobile insurance, but Ways and Means thought otherwise. There's no what's going on.
Chair moves the adoption of the amendments proposed by Mr. Rawls. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the adoption to the amendments by Mr. Rawls?
Move the bill out as amended.
Mr. Burbage moves the bill to the floor. Discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbage?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Pardon me?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstein?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. I can excuse, let's see.
I think the
who's gone?
Would like to leave.
I don't need it now. Oh, okay. Okay.
These two.
One, two, three. You want to stay?
No, don't. As long as I can get my hands on a calendar and maybe have a few minutes to look at the order in which some bills are coming up down there.
Okay, Jerry's gone for a third reading calendar, and I have to go down pretty soon to carry a bill, a landlord-tenant bill. All of you who are no votes can stay here.
Which bill is that? 2061.
You may leave, Betty. We're not going to have any more work session. We're going to take testimony on bills.
Oh, okay. We only got four people here.
One, two, three. No, we got five here.
You're one, Bob.
Okay, let's go to House Bill 2684. where am I? Sign up, Jesus. Tom Augustine.
How was that number, Ben?
2684. We're going to try to take these that we can get through kind of rapidly. Is there no one in the room who wants to testify on House Bill 3027 or 2863? You do? Which one?
Both of them.
But would you sign up on these sheets for me, please? Okay, on 2684, Mr. Augustine.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Hughes with representing the Oregon Credit Union League. Just a 20-second background on where this bill came from and what it's doing here. We have been working for, I say we, the credit unions, been working for a year and a half putting this model act together. We've had all kinds of input from the superintendent of banks, from our own people, and consequently have developed what we think is a total good revision of the Credit Union Act. I believe later, maybe you'll hear from the superintendent of banks, and he rather echoes our belief at this point. By way of background, there are 254 credit unions in the state of Oregon. They're divided like savings and loans. There are 39 state chartered with 45% of the assets. The balance are federally chartered. And total membership for credit unions are 350,000 members in the state of Oregon. We believe that, so far as we can tell, in the length of time we have spent putting this bill together, that all members of the credit unions, be they federally or state, endorse the new act. It passed the House, and I think that's evident when you look at the calendar and see that it passed the House by one no vote. Here with me today to explain to you the Credit Union Act is Tom Augustine. I have just given your clerk a comparative analysis of this 33-page bill to be passed out. We hope that is self-explanatory. And Tom will hit the highlights and give you a briefing on this document that we passed out. Connie, did we get those passed out?
Oh,
good. We represent Tom Augustine with the Oregon Credit Union League.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, as Ted mentioned, we've worked with the bill for a year and a half, and I'd like to just go over some of the highlights of the amendments, because much of it is housekeeping. We've tried to take the existing law and redefine many of the areas, give it better definitions so that not only could the credit unions understand how they're supposed to operate, but so that it can be better regulated and administered. Some of the major areas that we have added to the law are those of protection for the members and for the organization. We have added a section to govern out-of-state credit unions that should operate within the state of Oregon by branching where their main offices are in other states. Up to this point in time, there have been no provisions for the administration or to ensure proper operation in that area. We've also gone into the spelling out certain regulations for record keeping of the credit unions, the keeping of the vital records, placing bonding requirements on the officers and staffs. They have been minimal up to this point in time, and it's a further expansion for the protection of the assets of the credit union. We have gone into a mandatory share insurance provision, which is equivalent to the FDIC. Currently, there is only one national insuring corporation, that is the National Credit Union Administration, which insures the assets of all the federally chartered credit unions throughout the country. This is mandatory for them. Within this law, there is a mandatory provision for share insurance, which could be another corporation that would have to be approved by the superintendent of banks, or it would fall under the NCUA.
Mr. Augustine, are you following in any order the sections of the bill here, or are you just hitting the substantive points?
I've basically been trying to just hit the highlights. I can go through it.
No, just so you keep us in some some order, because we like to look at the bill and we like to look at your explanation, and it might be a good idea if you kind of pinpoint where you are.
Okay. I'll start on page 6 then, under the membership area, and I'll get to the share insurance again later. Under the direction of affairs in the credit union, up to this point in time, most of the committee people have been elected by the membership, since credit unions are membership organizations. They've elected credit committees, supervisor committees, and so forth out of their membership. This provision will place more of the burden on the board of directors to appointing people with the expertise to oversee the operation, rather than having just an election out of the membership. Many of these people will come out of the membership, they would have to, but it at least would place the responsibility with the board of directors for governing the affairs. There is an optional provision in here, and it would depend on the credit union whether they wanted to elect their committee members or to have them appointed by the board. We've provided page 7.
Article 5, we provide that also a credit manager may be used in lieu of credit committee. Is that just one man that's a credit manager?
That's what this would do. It gives the option to the board of directors to either operate with a committee or to give the responsibility of loan officer. It's a similar situation as loan officer, except that the credit manager would be responsible for overseeing the entire loan department and be answerable to the board of directors. Currently, a committee oversees this, and then the committee reports to the board of directors. This is worded in the law that provides an optional provision to the credit union.
I've always thought that the foundation of this, and really what made the credit union function, and the one that I have belonged to for years, was the credit committee. Go ahead. We haven't got time. Let me talk to the...
He's a little ahead of us, I think. So you want to go back to page 7? Are you on 7 of the bill?
No, on the comparative analysis.
Prepared.
Okay. Within the existing law, there were no provisions for conflicts of interest either, and this is an area that we have added to the new law and expanded so that it'll give protection to the corporation from any groups of people delving within their own interests. In section 32,
on that point, ma'am.
The law would
prevent them from participating or make them designate that they have a potential conflict?
They would have to designate and prohibit them from participating in any decisions where their own interests would be affected. If they were an officer within the corporation, they would have to withdraw from the decision-making capacity.
Would that be like a vote?
Yes, on the board of directors passing on some particular policy that might be a benefit to a group of members or someone. Well, if the board member had a vested interest in what was going to happen, he would have to withdraw from the decision-making process.
Do you have a definition of conflict of interest in the Act, or what are you going to go by?
It's spelled out in the Act to summarize pretty much the way I stated to you, that if he has the interest in this particular, there's no set definition relating to it except the way it's stated in the bill. It says, no director, committee member, officer, agent, or employee of the credit union shall in any manner directly or indirectly participate in the deliberation upon or the determination of any question affecting his pecuniary interest or the pecuniary interest of any corporation, partnership, or association other than the credit union in which he is directly or indirectly interested. the reason I'm excluded from the credit union, because he is a member of the credit union, and by sitting on the board of directors, he does pass on policy, but it would prohibit him from participating in the decision making if there were any other vested interest other than membership.
Could he discuss it with the people involved in decision making by withdrawing? Would that be indirectly? What I'm getting at is that the person somewhat directly involved might have good information and the expertise needed and for decision making. And I'm wondering if it's clear that the person could at least give advice in that case.
Well, I think this would probably boil down to the board of directors seeking information, and that would have to be their determination. I don't know whether this prohibits them from giving information, but I think if the deliberation upon the decision...
Well, I'll look at that at some depth and try to...
In Section 32, we've talked towards the executive committee of the board that an executive committee could be appointed to act on behalf of the board and make certain decisions, since sometimes the board people are widespread and there are smaller groups to maintain the operation of the credit union. This provision is not provided in the existing law. So it simply expand their power to handle the day-to-day activities of the organization. We go to page 8, section 38, and it deals with the credit manager, again, that Senator Brown was alluding to. And I might just touch on that. We would be dealing with the day-to-day activities of the organization rather than having to pass on all loans to a credit committee, that there would be the option of having a credit manager who could deal in this area and still be directly responsible to the board of directors. Go to page 10, and in section 50 we deal with dormant accounts, which has never been dealt with again in the current law. This is another area where probably the highest rates of embezzlements and other types of skullduggery take place in financial institutions is in dormant accounts, and the law spells out the handling of this particular area now, where in the old law it had no provisions. In the loan area, we have looked at some expanded powers on loans, allowing the boards of directors to set limits on secured and unsecured loan. We have changed the loan limits. Working with the superintendent of banks on this, where the previous individual loan limits to each member were $200 or 10% of the assets of the organization, whichever was greater. Simply meaning, if a $30 million credit union wanted to make a loan to an individual member, they could go as high as $3 million to that particular person. Under this particular section, it places the loan limit at least high enough to where we can deal in the current consumer market, buying automobiles and different things. However, it places a much lower individual loan limit by stating 15% of the guarantee reserve, which would then relate to any one given loss, would not eat up a tremendous amount of the reserve factor that the credit unions have. The way the existing law was stated, that theoretically, if one large loan were made on the basis of a, let's say, $30 million organization, it could wipe out the entire reserve picture of the organization.
Chairman.
Senator Smith.
I'm sorry, I'm back on page 10. Would you look at page 10 of the bill?
Of the bill?
In the... In Article 3, powers of credit union, will you tell me in what areas you've expanded
the powers of the credit union beyond existing law, if any?
I think that they're pretty much the same as the existing law was.
You have the powers to assess currently charges to members in accordance with the bylaws for failure to meet promptly their obligations.
Which,
that's mine. Page 10, section 14. Subsection 14.
The current bylaws allude to charges that can be assessed to members on delinquency and other factors. This is something that's there that is very seldom used in this area, because generally our delinquencies, when we end up in this area, we either collect the debt or it gets charged off. And the membership, it provides for the board to set policy for expulsion and different things, and charges.
Do the bylaws differ between credit unions?
Generally in fields of membership and who they serve, and there are certain peculiar things that have happened per credit union. Along with this law, we have redrafted the bylaws to standardize all of this, which will have to be approved by the superintendent of banks after the law is enacted.
Okay, so back to section 16, when you've added the word refer to this act and its bylaws, then you have really standardized, or at least authorized, all the bylaws by the Commerce Commission.
Yes, by the bank.
Okay. Then on page 11, again under powers, you provide that the credit union may purchase or make available insurance for its directors, officers, agents, employees, and members.
Right.
So if I buy one share of a credit union stock, I may be allowed to have dental, health, life, insurance, what? What are you talking about?
Well, currently, credit unions provide life savings and loan protection for their members at no cost to them. We cover their savings up to a maximum of $2,000. And again, this is optional by credit union. Also, the loan protection insurance is a blanket coverage covering all the loans outstanding up to $10,000. Currently, as other financial institutions, we now make available temporary disability insurance to members that they purchase and goes through an agent and agency situation. This particular situation allows the credit union to buy bonding coverage and other forms of protective coverage for the boards of directors, which they would need. Since they operate on a volunteer basis, they should be covered from personal liability in the course of doing business. But it would also allow the credit unions that if a good package were available to the members because of a mass marketing situation, that the credit union could make the insurance available to the member, and it would be his choice dealing with the agency or so forth. This was just simply dealing in that realm.
So in other words, this language would allow you to provide for any kinds of insurance that your boards of directors and officers might determine that was available?
Yes.
Was this an existing law?
It was silent. It was a silent factor in the powers. It alluded to the life savings, loan protection areas in the law. Purchasing of insurances for board members and so forth.
In other words, it identified it specifically.
No, it was silent in any mass marketing situation at all. This is what the area that we have been dealing in. The credit unions will not be in a position of selling or an agency situation unless they can qualify for that through the existing insurance laws. The intent of the bill as drafted is to make on a group mass marketing basis the insurance available to the members dealing through an independent agent or agency situation.
Okay.
Would the question of a new insurance program have to be authorized by the Commissioner of Commerce?
With every insurance program, the advertising and marketing of it has to be approved by the insurance commissioner.
Well, of course, you're under the Commerce Commission.
Well, we're under the banking, the superintendent of banks.
In this bill, right?
Yes.
I thought you were under Commerce.
No, we always have been. The savings and loans are the only ones that have discussion.
Then let me ask you the question again. Not that I'm considering that you're going to be a dispenser of insurance, but does your broadening your latitude in providing insurance for your directors or your employees or your members, must that be authorized by the Banking Commission before you begin to do it?
Well, I think that the law would allow it, and I'm sure the superintendent of banks would have something to say about the manner in which any program is administered by the credit unions. Within the law, there is a section that provides for the cease and desist powers to the superintendent of banks. I believe it's in a bill that was offered by the superintendent of banks, which we concur with wholly regarding any program that we would be involved in.
Would you oppose a provision that required that prior to the time that you made available any kinds of insurance, as we have under subsection 23, that you have the authorization of the Banking Commission?
No, I wouldn't find any problem with that. I think that the...
I believe we must already have authorization from the insurance commission.
From the insurance commission.
Under the insurance code, Senator.
Well, that's the dispensing insurance, and I'm not really dispensing it.
We've dealt with Mr. Rawls regarding insurance for about a year and a half involving in this, and I think that the in the area of offering it, it's a matter of, as a group purchasing base, that here is a company, here is an agent or agency, and that's the only area.
All right, I won't take any more time, Mr. Chairman. I'll investigate that myself.
I just want to make sure now that where we are on this thing. Now, if I am a member of the credit union, which I'm a member of the Portland Fire Department Credit Union, then could you apply personal liability under a group plan for me under this policy?
On the life savings and loan protection, yes. The credit union would be able to.
You can protect my loan?
Yes.
You can supply me with credit life?
Yes.
But would it go any further than that?
We could buy insurance, any blanket policy that the credit union would want to do, but this would get very prohibitive if we were buying insurance for all the members. But all we could do is say, here is a program, and if you would like to take advantage of it, we've looked at it, we think it's a good program, and the decision is yours. There's currently a program in the auto field that operates in mass marketing. There are a number of mass marketing programs that are simply made available to the membership, and they choose, they fill out an application, submit it for a quote on their own personal basis. The credit union isn't involved in it at all, other than simply stating to the member that this is available.
I realize that a lot of the firemen go to the credit union and borrow the money to pay the insurance agent and pay the premium on the policy. But what I don't want to do is to have some company go to a credit union and say, I'll sell you a group policy for all your members, and you just take it out of their savings or out of their payments each month, and have you bypass the insurance agents of Oregon.
Well, I think through any mass marketing program, it's dealing through the agency system. Every program that I've been involved in, or been part of is dealt through an agency system that has been approved by the insurance commissioner.
I want that checked out before I can send this thing out of here. This is the big fight that's going on in the industry right now is the banks going into the insurance business, and their bills going through the other way to stop the banks. This expands it for savings alone. As long as they're in there, I can support it.
Senator Howard, why don't we, for you and Senator Smith, do a more in-depth survey of exactly where we're at and where we used to be in the old...
I'll check with him with the...
And we'll give that to
you. That Mr. Rolls and... It is gone, but I'll check it out real quick.
Yeah,
he's coming back. We've offered in the new law there a number of alternative loan programs regarding line of credit and the ability of the credit union to purchase the outstanding contracts of their members, which they have not been able to do if they have them with any other financial institution or any retailer or so forth. And the credit union would be able to purchase these contracts rather than necessarily renegotiate if whichever direction the member would want to go. And this has been silent.
Give me a second. Stop your time.
I moved to page 11 on the comparative analysis, which deals with the liability of insurances for the directors and officers and employees, and the share insurance provisions, which would make it mandatory for the insurance prior to 1978. And the reason we put that date in there is just so that we can be sure that every credit union in the state would be able to comply with the laws. We feel there are no problems that we know of, but it would have to be a one-by-one situation to make sure, and there are 39 credit unions, and we'd like to be sure that they all can comply with the law. Currently, 11 of them are insured with the National Credit Union Administration, and there are more are applying for this insurance daily.
And credit life, is there any stipulation in here that it has to be with CUNA?
No.
No, all right.
No. We have an area on group purchasing which would allow the credit unions to invest funds up to maximums to move into other areas on a group purchasing basis. This is limited by law to 1% of their capital is the maximum that they could invest in any venture of this nature. The area of reserving would retain the requirements that the National Credit Union Administration would indicate, because they are different than the current law, and this law provides for a different reserving figure, which we've gone over with the superintendent of banks also. On page 13 of the comparative analysis, we, in section 70 and 71, we have provided for liquidation and merger procedures, which were reasonably silent in the existing law, and this would be going from either state to federal charter, or federal to state charter, or the merging of two unlike organizations. On page 14 of the analysis, we've talked to the acts of prosecution in case of violation of the law or any other criminal laws, the where and how these acts should be prosecuted, and the types of penalties that should be invoked regarding any criminal acts, felonies, or misdemeanor. These were silent in the current law also.
Senator Smith.
Yes, I'm listening and reading, so I'm behind you a little bit. Page 20.
On the bill?
On the bill. Loans.
Yes.
Line 23. Is the normal limit in other regulated states for credit unions 1.5%?
It varies throughout the country. There are, I believe, 18 states currently that have rates in excess of 12%, and they range from up to 18%. There have been laws introduced in quite a few other states to go beyond the traditional 12% limit that credit unions have had over the years. Currently, we have a 12% maximum, and it's been in the law since 1928 when the first law was written. Currently, also, our analysis of this area is that the average percentage that's charged is around 10.2, covering all loans from 6% on up to 12%. I couldn't give you what the dollar volumes are. The reason that we moved towards change in this area is because of the problems that we incurred in 1969, the problems we've incurred in the last couple of years on the pure money flow situation. And earlier this year, late last year, we had credit unions paying between 11 and 12% to borrow money from other financial institutions or any source.
Section 54, it seems that there is an attempt at a limitation. But if you have a large credit union, then really 15% of the guarantee fund and undivided earnings. So I don't know what that constitutes of the assets of your.
Well, I might give you an example. As a credit union in the Eugene area has assets of about $9 million, and their total guarantee fund and reserving is right at $500,000. So what we'd be talking about is a $75,000 loan maximum.
Is that it?
I have no more. Most of the changes that we have introduced in this law, again, have come through the members and through the credit unions to us to try to update the law. Just to reiterate what Ted pointed out, the original law was written in 1928, and we've had 48 amendments in 5 different sessions of the legislature, and because of the change in economy and moving to a different system of finances, we felt it imperative that we update the current law so that we can function in the financial community as other entities do. Many areas of the new law speak towards provisions that will allow us to function in these fields and within our own membership field also.
Some of the changes incorporated in the Model Act also allow state chartered credit unions the same latitude as now enjoyed by federally chartered credit unions. Brings them closer together.
Senator Powell, you had a question?
Are credit unions currently taxed in the same manner as mutual savings and loans?
Yes. It's if you see the dividend of 8%, then you are subject to the excise taxes. We added another provision to this bill because we deal with the cooperative investment area that a credit union might be able to get into. And we've added these provisions on taxation so that any unrelated credit union business that credit union might go into would be taxed under normal corporate status, so that we're not, you know, credit unions currently are tax-free because of their membership position. We're not endeavoring to circumvent the tax structure of the state by any means, so this was updated and put into the law.
Any other questions? Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on 2684? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Is there anybody here from Mr. Ombach
who
wants to testify?
I'd like to ask Mr. Owens a question.
All right. Mr. Owens?
Yes, sir. I'm interested in proceeding on the line of questioning regarding the ability of credit unions to issue and make available all kinds of insurance for their members, directors, officers, and employees, recognizing that they can have ability to make assessments against their members on the one hand, if it's authorized by the bylaws, which must be authorized by you, then I'm wondering what kind of controls are available, if any, for the regulation of a credit union making itself out to be an insurance company under the guise of a credit union.
Well, I don't think that's the intention of the Act. In my impression of this particular section, and this is not new to hearings in this section of the legislature, under the old law, they could purchase for their borrowers credit, life, and accident and health and that sort of thing. And even though it was done free to the members and also insurance on their savings account for a life plan, they had to do it through agents. And it wasn't free because even though it appeared to be free for the members were buying it in one form or another, either through the interest rate that they were paying or the use of the money that they were depositing. Now, as I understand this, it means that they may purchase or make available whatever plan of insurance, group or otherwise, accident and health or whatever, to their employees and members and directors and officers, but I don't grasp where they could do it other than through licensed agents. Am I not right on that? Or are they? I mean, the control is not in the banking department, the control is with the insurance commissioner. Now, we obviously have no particular plan, nor do we have any precedent for regulating this in some other manner than that they have to obey the insurance laws. Now, if that isn't clear, it can hardly be clear.
I'll get out, as I said earlier, I'll get out this person.
Sir Ellen, are you aware of House Bill 2915?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Would that affect the question Senator Smith has?
I haven't seen the recent amendments, but I do remember some discussion by Representative Rogers, I believe, on the subject, and my impression it would affect any financial type of organization, whatever it does.
Okay, it would prevent them, as I understand it from my mail, not having read the bill in detail, but from my mail, as I understand it, it would address the very problem that
yes,
Smith
well,
concerned.
It was. Its author is also interested in the concept that Senator Howard brought up.
Turn that on so I can hear you a little bit. Will you, buddy? Do your mic, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Okay.
I said that in the other committee, this subject was brought up, 2915 was in that same committee, and my impression was that that bill would affect banks, credit unions, savings loans, whoever, in whatever field. Now, what the final...
It case that doesn't pass, I want it in the hearing.
Well, you weren't here when I made this statement, but it was my impression that the credit union must purchase whatever they do here in the way of providing insurance of whatever type. They've got to buy it through licensed sources. Am I wrong in that?
Well, I don't know. What does this language mean? A credit union may enter into cooperative marketing arrangements to facilitate its members' voluntary purchases of insurance, disability, accident, health, property, liability, and legal expenses.
That means that they can go out and buy insurance. But I think the point is, where do they buy it?
If it says they must buy it to a licensed agent,
then you're that to be sure.
And that's what they do now.
Yes.
But this, I want to be darn sure that they have to continue it and that they don't go to some company and say, hey, we'll group and buy the insurance for our whole membership on their automobile.
Senator Howard, may I respond? You brought me out of the hall. I was watching you on television. You said you would like that language from House Bill 2915 inserted in here. I made the comment in the House side that very comment came up. That if it goes in here and this becomes law, 2915 does not in fact pass and become law, then the credit unions will be handicapped a very special way that they now are not.
No, he didn't say that, Ted.
Oh, I thought I heard that in the hall. That's why I came sworn.
No.
I'm sorry.
No, he didn't say that.
Oh, I thought I heard that.
No,
no.
No,
no.
You stay in here, Mr. Hughes.
Oh, don't go out the hall, man.
Don't you believe that you're in the hall.
I was watching you on television.
He's distorted on television.
Any other questions, Mr. Walker? Did you have any...
Well, I have only one general statement to make without going into the whole bill at all, is that the bill, or the law that we have now is a bad law. It's a hodgepodge. You can't fight your way through it. It's difficult for anybody organizing a credit union to know where they go, and nothing is defined. We've got a lot of definition in here of how they conduct themselves, how their board must operate, what we do in the case of a problem credit union, what their lending powers are, what their limits are, and particularly the limits. That has been streamlined down to match pretty much the lending criteria that we have for banks. Before, it was just wide open. And I think it's a very tightened up bill. It's one that you can read as a credit union member and understand. We were at a loss before, with the exception of maybe some minor cleanup things that you've spoken to today. I think it's a very good enactment. It's had a lot of hard work on it. I'm really for it.
Any other questions?
I
want to ask you a question, but we're still in the door. How long is it going to take?
We've
got a lot of other bills.
Just get to him later. All right.
You can ask him later. Well, that ends the hearing on 2684.
Go ahead, I'll come and talk to
you. We'll go to 2524. Walt Ripson.
Walt, you're on.
Committee. My name is Walt Rixon. I'm representing the Real Estate Commissioner's Office, and we're, of course, in favor of House Bill 2524. We've gone through a lot of work, a lot of meetings. I have submitted to the committee a one-page sheet here, summary sheet. I don't know if you have this. You do now. This is a rather interesting. We have an emergency clause on this bill. And we thought, you know, we would get this thing done fast. We've had some problems in writing the thing. Didn't get it properly lined up. I was doing a lot of it in the writing myself, and we got some legislative counsel involved, and we got some changes. We combined two different bills. Representative Stoltz has helped us on this thing, and he's in favor of the bill. We have, it clarifies existing law, if I can read this with you, relieves the present legal requirements as to billing and factoring services by creating two new licensing categories with less burdensome requirements. It provides the state with receivership powers for the protection of unpaid creditor customers and their debtors. It spells out record keeping and audit requirements. This bill represents the work product of a broadly based industry committee working with the Department of Commerce during the past year and some 40-odd meetings and conferences. In the House, important improvements were made with the active leadership and assistance of Representative Robert Stoltz. Under the new act, the department would be authorized to take action in the following presently existing situations about which it is under existing law powerless to act. Matter case number 74 WCC, while under audit by the department, the owner of this agency surreptitiously, I like that word, removed entire trust account records. The agency's mail is presently being forwarded to a P.O. box in California. The department estimates in excess of 2,000 trust monies undistributed. That was about last count. We're still getting calls and people and debtors are saying they've made their payments. Creditors are saying they haven't received anything. And we really don't have any authority to say stop the mail at this point. With receivership capacity that this bill would provide, we would be able to take some action. There is another agency whose headquarters is located outside the state. They've been having trust checks returned referred to Maker. They change operators, and there's about 130 trust checks that I know of that have been bouncing around the city of Portland and around the state, and we're getting the anonymous phone calls. What are you doing about this? Well, this is one of the situations that we really don't have any authority to go in and put a stop because the guy's out of state at the present time. We have 9 agencies with tax liens of record. We have 7 agencies without qualified management and actual control. This bill, it passed through the House with a 52-2 vote. If you have any questions, I'd sure be glad to review them with you.
Any questions of Mr. Dixon? No, thank you very much. Wynn Greer.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Collectors Association. We have 85 members, which is a little over 65% of the licensed collection agencies in the state. Prior to my present position, I spent over 40 years in the collection agency business here in the state. Served 2 terms on the collection agency board from 1957 to 1961. Well, the Oregon Collectors Association supports this bill because it is a good, constructive piece of legislation, and particularly the receivership provision. We've needed this for a long time. That is good for the industry as a whole, and the department will have authority to appoint a receiver who can liquidate an agency in an orderly manner and account for the collections and return accounts and avoid bad publicity. And 2, it's very good for the creditors because it protects their money and provides an accounting of the funds and return of their accounts in case the agency could not be sold. And it's good for the debtors or the consumers because it gives them availability to the records, a record of their payments, and make sure that they get the proper credit on monies they paid in. So we support this and trust that you'll give us a favorable vote on it. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer.
Any questions, Mr. Greer?
Thank you
very much. Bob Simpson.
This is 20.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Simpson, attorney from Portland. I represent Transport Clearings Northwest. I've prepared a statement
which I would just like to read through. Your clerk has copies of the statement there for you. Transport Clearing is an Oregon nonprofit corporation, and like a co-op, it's owned by its members, which are all freight carriers. Transport Clearing purchases accounts receivable freight bills from its members, which get immediate cash, sorts the bills by the customer, shipper, or receiver of freight, and mails the bills to the responsible party for payment. The service provided to the shipper is one check can be made out to pay for all the shipper's transportation charges instead of many checks to many carriers. The service provided to the member carriers other than immediate cash is that they turn over to specialists the processing of their accounts receivable, which in the case of a small Oregon truck line is of substantial benefit. Transport Clearing purchases the freight bills from its members without recourse and thereby becomes the owner of the bills, and payment of the bills is then made to Transport Clearing. Without recourse means that Transport Clearing absorbs the loss if the freight bill is not paid. Because Transport Clearing buys the freight bills, it doesn't have at any time any of its customers' funds. The service is performed in Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Southern Idaho, and Western Montana. Less than 30% of its service is performed in the state of Oregon. A reading of ORS Chapter 697, the collection agency statute, would demonstrate that as applied to Transport Clearing, its provisions become meaningless. However, because of the words "by outright purchase for collection purposes" in ORS 697020, paragraph 3, the Real Estate Commissioner of Oregon has taken the position that Transport Clearing is covered by the statute. Consequently, Transport Clearing supports House Bill 2524. In particular, I'd refer you to page 3 of the bill. The language "persons, firms, or businesses who purchase accounts without recourse" is added to the exemption section. That's the particular provision that Transport Clearing has supported. We had a little different language on the House side, and Mr. Rickson and the members of that committee put this language in, which is perfectly acceptable to us and to the Real Estate Commissioner. The language which the Commissioner took the position late last year, which covered Transport Clearing, is contained in line 5, also on page 3. Outright purchase for collection purposes. That language was added to the statute in, I believe, 1965 as a housekeeping measure, according to the testimony given the committee at that time, to take care of a situation where a collection agency had purchased with recourse its accounts just to get out from under the regulation of the statute. But because Transport Clearing buys the freight bills outright, it never has any money belonging to anybody but itself, because it's collecting its own bills from that point forward. Consequently, it's not covered by any of the other terms of this statute as it is now on the books or as amended by House Bill 2524. Not being covered, it's to require Transport Clearing to perform a useless act, which is making a lot of reports to the Commissioner about funds that belong to Transport Clearing and not to its customers. It's an entirely different kind of an organization than a collection agency, and consequently should be exempt from the operation of the statute.
Which you are now and you like.
I make the legal argument, Senator, that the statute was not intended by the legislature to cover an account receivable factor who purchases bills without recourse anyway. But there is a question, as you can see, the Real Estate Commissioner took the position last year that we were covered. As a result, we're asking the legislature now to specifically exempt this kind of organization, because it shouldn't be covered anyway.
It was covered before, wasn't it? Just to get the record straight, but it was my understanding that because of this language on page 3, you are exempt, which you want to be.
Because of the language on line 17 and 18 of page 3, will exempt Transport Clearing in the future, as this is one of the amendments.
That's right. Okay.
Right. So if the Senate then concurs with the House amendments, that would exempt Transport Clearing. That's right.
Okay. Any questions?
I didn't even listen. I can't ask
that question. That's good. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Fred Venata.
Don't tell me you're going to be against the bill.
Nope.
Good.
I am Fred Venata, appearing on behalf of myself and my partner who operate at Billing Service. The other thing that, or one of the other things this bill does is as we see it, broaden the coverage of registration with the collection agency board to cover billing services. The amendment that you have before you would exempt a billing service operating at not more than one location, which is also on the premises of the creditor. I will tell you that, explain to you the kind of a circumstance that we are in and why we don't feel that it's necessary that we come under this law. We operate, in effect, a doctor's office, and we do their billing for them. Our address is their address. The only reason we come under this law is that instead of being regularly salaried employees, we operate on a percentage of the money that is collected that runs through their office. If we were on a salary instead of a percentage, we would not come under the law. But by virtue of the fact that we are operate on a percentage, and in effect winds up as a contractual relationship rather than an employer-employee relationship, we come under the law. This is a simple exemption, and it only exempts those cases where that are like ours, and there are very, very few of them. Now, there's no opportunity here where you're operating a guy's office. You have a very close relationship, and there's no opportunity to rip off the people you're working for any more than if I were on a salary and able to steal money from my employer. The other reason for regulation of billing services and collection agencies, I think, is because they go out and torment the people that are slow pay, if you will. We don't do that any more than we would if we were on a salary instead of on a percentage. I'm not sure that my friends in the real estate division will support these amendments because they want money. And I'm sure they think my fees are as good as anybody's fees. Because we think that really the fees under this are pretty high for a small business, in effect a business that's a sideline. We commend this amendment to you.
Excuse me, we've got to call the Senate on. We've got to do that. I'd like to have, is there any opposition to that amendment?
Yes, there is.
Yes, you may. 2524. Here is President's suggested amendment.
I would question an in-house operation being exempt. I don't feel that this is necessarily a criteria.
Who is he?
I feel that the, and I can appreciate his thinking, wanting to be exempt from this section of law. There are other people that can write in under such an exemption and can create problems. I would like to refer to the debt consolidation law, if I may, where they took and certain nonprofit agencies came and they said, we're nonprofit and we should be exempt from the law. And legislature assisted, and because it was a low budget thing for them and they couldn't really afford all the things relative to being licensed and regulated,
and so they gave them the exemption because they were nonprofit filing under Chapter 61. As a result, other businesses went nonprofit with them and started out, and we had no control. There's one lady, she was $3,000 short in her trust account in Eugene, and there was no way we could touch it because they were exempt from our law. And we had, there's about four other nonprofit agencies. Now, I'm not talking about Consumer Credit Counseling Service. They're doing a fine job, but other ones wrote in on the same exemption. I would not say that Mr. Van Etta's company is a bad company or anything like that, but I would be concerned that if you open the door for him, you may be opening the door for other ones that are not of the same caliber as Mr. Van Etta.
Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Can you give me an example of any other business that you know of that it's a billing service operating in not more than one location, which is on the same premises as the creditor?
Northwest Billing Company are doing this for quite a few of them, not for all of them, but for quite a few of their doctors that they're doing this. Their license is a collection agency. They saw that they were doing a lot of the things that were put them under the collection agency law.
Are they at more than one location?
No, they're in one location.
To be operating on the same premises as the creditor?
For a portion of them, not for all of them. For a portion of them, yes, they do.
Well, then they wouldn't come under this amendment.
No, not because of the few remaining doctors that would be on the outside of it, yes.
Is there any other that you know of?
At this point, I don't really know. I haven't.
Well, I'd like you to take a look, because I don't want to apply this to more than we're thinking about.
Uh-huh.
I'd like you to find one or more if you can for me. Will you do that?
I'll sure make every effort. I don't know.
Pretty well, if you don't, you know what's going to happen.
I'll make every effort.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Okay, are there other questions? Has everyone testified that wants to testify on this bill? Apparently we've got all four of you down.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to House Bill 2863. Stratton.
I'm Al Stratton, administrator of the Landscape Contractor Bill Department of Commerce. I passed out a little brochure there and also an enclosure of a definition on 671-520, paragraph 4. Bill has gone through, the House had an extensive evaluation over there in the workstation, and due to the time they decided we might as well send the bill out, there were several errors in the bill or things that were originally in it and passed by the committee, and they felt that in essence of time would be best to shoot it out immediately. On 671-520 was a little handout that you have. There are several gray areas in there, and we feel that the handout is a much better definition and will tie down what a landscape contractor is. There has been some problems in the past concerning this, and we think that this will actually tie it down. The architect.
Just a minute, Mr. Stratton. You're proposing that this landscape contractor definition be substituted for landscape contractor as it is now in the bill?
That's correct, yes, ma'am.
Okay, so on page 2, line 13, you would substitute this language, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, that is correct.
All right. Let me also interrupt here. Did you say that this bill passed the House with some errors or defects in it, but they thought it was better to get it on its way?
That's correct, ma'am. The one comment is on irrigation systems. It came through. It now has residential in the...
Well, are you prepared to identify each one of the places in the bill that you think we need to consider for change?
The only change is on this one paragraph that I have right here, the amendment paragraph that I...
Are there no other errors or problems?
No, ma'am. No, none whatsoever. These are the only errors that we found, and I talked to Representative Whalen on. He said bring it up to your
attention. And it's just the change in the definition?
Yes, ma'am. That is correct.
Okay, well, why don't you go ahead then and explain to us why you want this broader definition?
Actually, I think it's actually a narrower definition the irrigation system, we narrowed. This was to residential. Now we think it should be included to all irrigation systems. There's much confusion in the industry on this, whether a fellow is doing commercial or residential. The rest of it is a very gray area, and the architectural, horticulture, decorative treatment and arrangement should be added, because the bill as it sets today with this definition, it could almost include a farmer, and of course we don't want this in the landscape contractor's business, and we feel that this defines a little better so that the industry will know and we won't have any problems with the board. The rest of the bill is basically, it was a bill passed by the 71 legislature, and it's just basically housekeeping. I don't feel there's any controversial in that, or there was none in the committee either. Mr. Van Hey, do you have anything to add to this?
Chairman. I am Ron Van Hey, a landscape contractor in Portland. I serve as the chairman to the Department of Commerce on their advisory committee. Just to elaborate a little bit, going back to give you a little background, the definition as it was originally adopted two sessions ago is very much like this, with the exception of the exclusion of residential. And in the committee, the House committee, this session changed it around a little bit, and in the process they came up with what we have proposed here. The only problem was is that it was erroneously engrossed, and so consequently it left out for architectural horticulture, which defined it and set it aside from other agriculture. As far as the industry and the public, there's no opposition to this at all. We've went into extensive hearings and such for this. So I would like you to look with favor upon this one oversight that came through the House. And as Mr. Stratton said, Chairman Whalen said that he would certainly concur with the change, as of course it went back to the House, and would speak to that when it did return.
Senator Smith.
Bob, I got to go down and see Jack Ripple for the chairman. May I ask one question? And you?
Sure.
All right. Why, in lieu of a surety bond, can the man put up security with United States National Bank or...
Absolutely.
Why don't you put in here, you just say a surety bond, why don't they put in the other part of it?
I think it does speak to that.
It's called surety bonds, sir, or deposit required.
Oh, they just don't have it in the...
It's not in the chain. No, it is in the law.
That's right.
That's right.
I'll be right back.
I'll be right
back.
Okay, now, Senator Smith.
Where does it say that?
671.690, sir.
Well, what page and line? That helps us better.
Page 5 is
Section 8.
Is the area that I am on. But Section 9 does not say that.
I have a copy of... Sir, I have a copy of the present law. And it does spell that out. If I
but Section 9 is the present
section
law.
Section 9 is the present law. What does it say there? Well, you left it out, so.
Yes, I don't have it in my engrossed form.
No.
But it is part of the law. There's other parts of it that are...
If this is passed, this is the law. And all deposit requirement is not in it.
Where should it go, Bob?
It should, surety bond. Surety bond, surety bond. Surety bond on lines of, line 11. Insert, after surety bond, insert all deposit required. Well, then we've got, wait a minute, that won't work either. Or deposit required after corporate sureties. No. Well, I don't know, we're gonna, it's not in there anyway. Jerry can work it out.
Okay, in other words, the ORS hasn't been copied accurately in this bill.
That's right, to get at that point. Madam Chairman, I want to ask about this
bond. All right, go ahead.
Why have you raised the limits of the bond from 1,000 to 3,000?
It was in keeping with the home builders bonding, and it was suggested by the Attorney General that we be in Congress with these, since we do relatively the same type of business except no less.
What's the average contract that a landscape contractor does on a home?
On a home, I would say probably 5,000. Ours seem to be much more. I think they go all the way from zero to, we spent in excess of 60,000.
What's your average?
My average, I would venture to say, to be 5,000, 4,000.
What's the average for a $25,000 house?
It's out of ways with the committee.
I would imagine probably maybe 1,200,
2,000. And I didn't get checked.
We have several complaints at the present time, sir. One of them is running about $2,500 on the actual damage. And we have one that we just...
I don't want to leave before the other
contract is running about $4,000. At the present time, the 1,000 hasn't handled it.
Is that force tax, isn't it?
What in this bill is the license fee thing? Or is it in here?
It's under 671.650, sir. It's 4 mils per dollar on the income, on the gross income. And it runs basically from a minimum of $22 to $300. We haven't changed that in this proposal at all.
I have a meeting.
The millage on the gross is
this thing, because they're almost done there.
Okay.
And it's, so the gross now has to be $500, 5,000.
5,000 or more.
So it's, that's $20. It's 4 mils?
Four mils, that's correct.
4 mils. That's $20 to $300. Well, let me make a statement to you and then let you respond to it. As I did in the contractor's bill, I oppose this bonding requirement because I think that in the case of especially landscape contractors, that you are depriving some who may want to be landscape contractors who cannot meet the $3,000 bond requirement. And because they cannot, and because they can't operate, you say that you the department shall not license those who gross less than $5,000. But if they do, they must have a $3,000 bond, is that right? Well, I suggest that if you can't make more than $5,000 in the business, you'll never qualify for a $3,000 bond. My point is that I believe that in the attempt to regulate your industry, you're depriving people of entering it.
this wasn't the intent of the bond. In fact, it was in the last legislature. The industry or the board did not request this bond. It was requested by the committee that this bond be put in of the $1,000. And, of course, we had no objection to it. And at the present time, the complaints, some of them we had where claims had been made against the bonds, all of them had been over the $1,000. And we felt this would be then probably more equitable on the $3,000 in that, well, we thought another board was doing this as well, and we thought this would be the equitable way to bring it up to the $3,000 in that the fee for a $3,000 bond was very negligible in comparison to the $1,000, the increase. However, we may stand corrected on this.
The premium that I pay for my $1,000 bond is $25 for 3 years. I would imagine that it wouldn't double. I've heard that it would probably cost maybe $10 at the very outside to pick up the other $2,000. So this would be $35. I, as a businessman, I don't want to become argumentative, but I think this is not an overwhelming consideration as far as a businessman, I wouldn't think, to pick up that extra $2,000.
Madam Chairman, no, I don't think it is for you. And if I were an insurance company, I would give you the bond to try to get your other insurance business. I'm talking about the guy that doesn't qualify for a bond and can't receive a bond because he doesn't qualify monetarily. And he's a risk to the insurance company. Rather than allowing them to have a bond, they won't give him any until he could either have the amount of money available in cash or other security.
The thing that concerns me, and it did from the very beginning, and I've been involved with this ever since its inception, is that they are a risk. And we as board members to this advisory committee do service the complaints. And it's very difficult for us to answer or speak to someone who has been wronged with no possibility of getting it back, with the exception of maybe a bond, where they can't attach the bond. This makes it difficult, and morally, is for me as a contractor, I have nothing to say to them. I really think that they should be responsible. They are a risk, and I have no intentions of ever putting a fence around this industry, as Madam Chairman knows from the very beginning. We had consumer protection, and we had improving of the industry. And that's the way it should be. I don't think we should try to exclude anyone. But here again, if it's going to be meaningful at all, I think we should have some guidelines and some protection for the public.
That's all our questions.
Okay. Anybody else have questions?
Like fence building.
I missed this.
Oh, that's an in joke.
All right.
You know all about it. You know all about it. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Stratton, how long will it take you on 3027?
I have nothing on it, ma'am. I'm completely neutral on it. As you recall, this is one of the big controversial issues last session, and this time the two presidents of the two organizations got together and came up with this. And,
Jerry, were the TV people notified on
30? I don't know. I'd have to check our list, but I would expect.
Okay, we better get representing both groups in here. They told me that too as I was passing them in the hallway one day, and I could hardly believe them because of the controversy that's been going on around here for so many years.
I realize this. However, the presidents of the two groups are handshakers today, and they did not testify at the House.
Well, but now, as I recall, in a special session, they were grandfathered in, right?
They extended for 1 year.
For 1 year. Now, what does this bill do? Grandfathered them in permanently?
Just with the... They must take a test this time, and the people who have the provisional license, the grandfather people, then they must obtain a minimum of 75 points. These points are attained by 1.5 years of age and 1 year in the business. So basically a fellow 50 years old already has 75 points. Then he must take a test and attain a score that will be determined by the Director of Commerce and the Advisory Board. And we feel at this time will be something between 65 and 70, or between 60 and 70. This is just a guess.
They make points on age?
Points on age. This way they will be a grandfather.
Any compulsory retirement for television repair?
Well, they must have 8 years, because the bill's been in effect now 4 years, so they must have 8 years. As to hold provisional license, they must have had 4 years previous to the enactment in 1971. So they would automatically have 8 years. That's the minimum they could have.
I'm sure.
Senator Justice.
What would I have to do to go about to demonstrate that I have I have to demonstrate satisfactory evidence that I have a good moral character?
You never could.
I know. That's what bothered me.
That has been taken out of the bill on 2495, House Bill. The good moral character, and it was put, may refuse the license if convicted of a felony.
But it's in this bill.
Right, it is in this bill. However, my understanding is the other will override that. If this is not a change of the good moral character. This is just the paragraph. We're not changing that of good moral character.
What's the other bill number?
2495.
What does it do?
Increases the fees, some housekeeping. This is the 2495 is sponsored by Department of Commerce. This one is strictly a private bill.
Okay, Jerry, we better see if there's conflict with House Bill 2495 on this language, and also check with the TV people and tell them at least to give us a letter that there's no conflict between the two, so that we have it.
I did contact the presidents yesterday and today, and they both said they were not going to testify that I couldn't for them, but
Meeting's adjourned. Oh, wait a minute. Chris Christensen. How long did it take you on 2489?
Not more than 5 minutes.
Okay. You, Bob, go ahead. And John, go ahead.
No, Ken, no. Not more than 5 minutes. I can make that.
All right. 2489. I'm sorry.
They sit here the whole day. At least we can do is hear them.
Oh dear. As public member to Elevator Safety Board, is that all it does?
That's all that one does.
I'll try to run through this very quickly, and I'd appreciate your interruption with your questions. On page 2, line 17, we're only adding Building Codes Division that should have been added 2 years ago. Line 20 is a repeal section. I gave you a separate sheet on that. And it would repeal this section because it's that listing you see is meaningless, absolutely meaningless. And in fact, if it were to be meaningful, we should expand it about double. It talks about professional activities, and yet it's not. It contains things other than professional activities, and it does nothing in my estimation. It we don't need it. Page 2, lines 26, 27, 28, and this type of thing you'll see repeated often in the bill. It allows license renewal dates to be staggered, and this particular one has to do with plumbing business licenses. Page 3 is a carry further of that last item, allowing license dates to be renewed. Page 3, lines 11, 12, 13, 14 is the same thing for electricians. At the bottom of page, line 30, One problem here is that engineer's board gives the examination once a year in April, and in numerous instances, the applicant will not have completed the educational requirements for admission to the current year's examination until he has completed summer school. A hardship would be created if he were required to wait until the following year for admission to the examination. And on page 4, it deals with the same thing, only a different section of the ORS. On page 4, line 30, tax service examiners has been a part of Commerce for 2 years, and that should have been added 2 years ago to that listing. Page 5 is a matter of allowing staggered renewal dates for landscape architects. Bottom of page 5, line 29, at times the engineers examiners find it a real problem in giving examinations in state when a person might be assigned temporarily in New York as an example, and they would like very much to have the ability to give examinations to be proctored by other states. This only comes up 2 or 3 times a year. Page 6 of the bill, line 18. This deals with land surveyors, and the volume we're talking about here on certificates is about 20 per year. And where it's now $5, the fee is $5, it costs more than $5 to issue this certificate. Lines 24, 25, 26.
Question, Madam Chairman.
Senator Jersey.
You mean it would be about 20 per year for the $50, but then how many would be for the additional 5?
I'm sorry,
if I understood you right, you would handle maybe 20 a year for the $50 certificate,
yes.
Did you say?
Yes.
All right.
Was still 20, no matter what the fee is.
All right. But then on the 5 to the $10 increase,
yes.
Would there be, what I'm getting at, we surely have more surveyors than 20 in the state.
Yes, this is for
annual renewal.
Well, this is for the land surveyor certificate. Only about 20 certificates are issued, and these are new registrants. These are not renewals.
Oh, I see. All right. I get it now.
Yes. All right. Lines 24, 25, 26 would raise this particular fee for a lost or mutilated certificate, and for $2.50, we can't now get that job done. And the $10 is perhaps a little misleading, but that's a maximum fee, and I think we wouldn't charge that, hopefully, for many years. Lines 30, 31, 32, 33, again, allow renewal dates to be staggered, and this is for engineers and surveyors. Page 7, lines 6 through 16, is the same thing of allowing renewal dates to be staggered. Line 19, section 13 is repealed item, and this is on your sheet also of the repealed statutes. This needs to be repealed because it's very costly to the Board of Engineers now to send out notices of rules and results of rules to all registrants. There are other ways to have engineers informed other than direct mail, which is very costly. On page 7, lines 26, 27, 28, and 29 deals with plumbers and again allows the license renewal dates to be staggered. Page 8, line 3 does that same thing for plumbers. Lines 17, 18, 19 does the same thing for watch and clock makers. Lines 28, 29, and 30 does the same thing for auctioneers. Page 9. Lines 10 through 17 would change a 9-member elevator board from 9 professionals to 8 professionals and 1 public member. Line 32 deals with landscape architects, and the $40 is not sufficient to carry out their budget, and this has the approval of Ways and Means. Unofficial approval, of course. The $75 is not a jump from 40 to 75. That's 75 is a maximum.
Okay, questions of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Christensen.
You bet.
Meeting is adjourned now.